You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
So tonight we have the opportunity to travel into the life of a remarkable young Afghani girl named Camilla, the subject of Gail Samak Limon's book, The Dressmaker of Kar Kana. Kamala's entrepreneurial spirit motivated her to spearhead a dressmaking business and training school that provided opportunity and community for the young women in her neighborhood during one of the most challenging periods in Afghani history. It's rare that we have the chance to peer behind the closed doors of a society that for so long has kept its women hidden. By her skillful weaving of Kamala's story, Gail provides us with an understanding of how women, given opportunities in business, are influencing a more peaceful future in Afghanistan and in all countries ridden with conflict. When the bombing of Kabul begins, Kamala notes, "Peace and a chance to pursue our dreams. That's all we can dare to hope for." I find her hope quite universal, one that is shared by young women and men here in the United States, and perhaps one that is pursued through the role of libraries in our communities. As her father reminds her, "It is much better to earn a living with a pen than with a sword." It's quite fitting to be able to share her story in our public library. Now for a bit about tonight's guests. Gail Samak Limon is a fellow and deputy director of the Women and Foreign Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. She covered presidential politics and public affairs for 10 years as a producer with ABC News, and this week with George Stephanopoulos, before leaving to write about women entrepreneurs in war zones. She served as an informal advisor on the topic of women's economic empowerment for General McChrystal's staff in Afghanistan, as well as economic officials at the American Embassy in Kabul. Did anyone happen to see Gail on the KTLA program this morning? No. Lisa Ling was called away on assignment, but we are fortunate and honored to have Kai Rizdal here tonight to interview Gail. Kai Rizdal is the host of Marketplace on American Public Media. Before joining Marketplace, Kai was a reporter and a host for the California Report, a news and information program distributed to the public radio stations throughout California. His radio work has won first place awards from the Radio and Television News Directors Association and the National Public Radio News Directors Association. Before his career in public radio, Kai served in the United States Navy, was a Pentagon staff officer, and was a member of the U.S. Foreign Service. Please join us in welcoming our guests.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, good job. Well, thank you all for coming. This is actually going to be a great conversation because this, in case you haven't read it and you're just here because you heard about it, awesome book. There is a certain rote nature to introductions at events like these, but I got to tell you, all this stuff about Harvard Business School and ABC News and PIMCO and Council on Foreign Relations, forget all that. And let me just tell you one fact about this woman that's going to make you go, wow. She's on a book tour, which most authors greet with a mixture of exhilaration and bald-faced terror. And she's doing it with a one-month-old baby in tow. So clearly, she's a person who can do anything. And I think that gets a round of applause all by itself. So we're going to go 50-ish minutes, Gail and I. And then we're going to open it up to whatever questions you may have. And we're going to get into the narrative of this amazing woman and what she did, Kamala Siddiqui. But the first question I think has to be, why Afghanistan? What took you from your first year at Harvard Business School, when you got plenty to do, to Afghanistan?
First of all, I'm so delighted that you're here, and I'm delighted that all of you made time in your busy schedules to join us this evening, so thank you. And it's a question that I think a lot of people in my family asked as well. But the truth was, I went to business school after being at ABC News for most of my 20s, and I went because I wanted to write about economic stories, about economic development stories in parts of the world people weren't covering. And I think people are so used to underestimating women and women's contributions that I wanted to write about women entrepreneurs in war zones, because I think so much of the war stories that we hear are men with guns, right? I mean, that's sort of all we think of when we think about what is war. But it's the women who make sure there are communities to go back to after the war is done. And almost no one ever acknowledges their contributions. And so when you think about what is it that women do, they keep families going. Well, how do they keep families going? They feed them. And so how do they feed them? They start businesses. And that is sort of how I backed into writing about this topic. I really came at it not as a women's story, but as an economic story that no one was paying attention to.
That's actually a really good point. And we talked about this when we had you on Marketplace a month ago. Nicholas Kristof, the New York Times, Larry Summers from the Obama White House, they are only a few of the people who say, listen, if you want to improve societies around this world, get women jobs. Help the women, and that's going to fix, like, everything, you know? This woman, Kamala Sadiq, who is she?
I think she is a young patriot who really believed that if she created jobs for her community, she would provide not just a lifeline, but real hope at a time of desperation. And what she did, you know, it was sort of an astonishing moment when I found her story, because I was working on a piece for the Financial Times looking for entrepreneurs, and I was writing a case for Harvard Business School about women in Afghanistan, businesswomen. And I met this gal, and we were in this really cold room because there's not a lot of heat. As you know, from tough parts of the world, there's not a lot of heat. So we're hovered over these cups of tea in Kabul at the offices of Mercy Corps, which some of you guys might know. And I said, well, how did you get started in business? And she told me she had just turned down this job that would have paid $2,000 a month working for the international community to start her own consultancy. And she was talking so passionately about why business was the key to change in Afghanistan. And this was 2005. And I said, well, look, I'm barely 30, and I know you're not 30, so how in the world do you know so much about business? And she said, well, I had this great business under the Taliban that created all these jobs for women in my neighborhood, and that was really a good business, and that's how I decided to become an entrepreneur.
Say that again. She was a woman who had a job under the Taliban.
Right. And not only did she have a job for herself, but she used that opening to create opportunity and hope for 100 women in her neighborhood who, you know, really would just start knocking on doors and saying, look, my cousin friend told me that you have work and my family is desperate. We have absolutely no way to feed all the mouths that we have in our house. And so I think her story, to your original question about why hers, was one story of one woman at one impossible time, at one very tough country that stood for so many others.
So let's tell the story a little bit for those who might not be familiar with The Dressmaker of Carcana. It opens in Kabul in September of 1996 with Kamala Siddiqui getting her teacher training certificate, literally graduation day. And she's on the bus home, and she hears women in the seats behind her talking about the Taliban, who are at the city gates.
And she, at that point, realizes that things are probably going to change in some way. But she, like so many other women, wasn't quite sure what that would mean. There were all these rumors. I mean, in Kabul, information travels faster than Western Union without any technology. I mean, rumors are rampant. And I don't know, some of you have spent time in these places. You know, you don't need technology, and you definitely don't need email. The family gossip and the extended family, the cousin's friend who goes to the neighbor's house to tell them what happened, that was in full effect. So people had heard what had happened in other cities. So the girls' schools were shut down immediately. Women couldn't go to work overnight. Everything changed. And she fears that this is what's going to happen, but she tries to be optimistic because she remains probably the most optimistic person I've ever met.
Trying to be optimistic, think about this for a second. She's 19 years old, in 1996. She was born 2 years before the Russians invaded. She, as you point out here, she and her generation have never known peace in her country. That's all they've ever known, and here it comes to her doorstep. Give us the thumbnail sketch of life in the early days in Kabul under the Taliban. I mean, it was, everything's fine one day, marginally so, and then it all shuts down.
Yeah, I mean, a curtain really came down over women's lives. The Civil War years, which I think people forget about, 1992 to 1996, Civil War ate Kabul alive. So about 30,000 people are estimated to have been killed. Rockets fell from the sky. I mean, people turned neighborhoods into trenches. So those had been bad, but girls like Kamala had kept going to school.
Yeah.
You know, they had gone to their father. She in particular had gone to her father and said, I want your permission to keep going to school because my older sister keeps yelling at me to stay home because she's worried about the rockets. And I say, God will protect me. And I'm not worried about it. And my job is to get educated. I'm going to go to school, come hell or high water. And so her father says, okay. So they had managed to eke out enough space, right, all of these years. And then come the Taliban. And every night over the radio, there will be no women going to university. All the women's schools will be shut. Women cannot be in offices anymore. Women must be fully covered by the burqa. Women cannot leave their houses without a male chaperone. So I cannot go out without my 12-year-old brother now, who counts as my male chaperone. And all of this came overnight for girls who had never owned a burqa, never lived in purdah, which is, you know, real sequestration away from male family members. So this was all totally new for these women.
There are many great scenes in this book. One of them early on is the family gathering around. Dad has his spot in what I guess was an EG chair or something in front of the radio, and they listen to the BBC. It was like straight out of World War II movies, right? The family listening to what's going on in the war through the wireless, if you will, when that meant radio.
Yes, and that the radio was a pivotal information, and it still is in Afghanistan because there's a country. It's a country with, you know, 85% female illiteracy. And about 60% male illiteracy. And so radio, especially at that time, because there was no TV. Now TV, I know some of you might have seen Afghan Star, right? So the Afghan version of American Idol, right? So that is a huge hit, as is WWE, by the way. So world wrestling is massive now in Afghanistan. But at that time, and certainly with the Taliban, you know, television was banned. But people didn't really have TVs anyway. So the BBC and Voice of America were the absolute lifelines.
This family. I mean, we started talking about this back in the green room, and I cut you off because I wanted to save the good stuff. Well, that's what you do, right? I mean, you can't waste the good stuff in the back room. Nine girls, two boys, right? The father was an Afghan army officer. Tell us more about him and the family and the environment in which Kamala Siddiqui grew up.
So she grew up in what was somewhat middle class, right? I mean, you cannot really have a sustained middle class during a war. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult for that to continue. But she was this man who felt so strongly that his girls were going to be educated because when he was a teenager, he worked at a $22 million Swiss-German factory in the north of Afghanistan and alongside European women. And he told me, I realized early on that the only thing that separated those women who were working in the factory from the women in my family was education. And so I felt absolutely determined that all of my children would be educated. And he said to me so many times, I look on all my children with one eye. And that's my boys and my girls. And our faith teaches us that we must be educated because that's how you contribute to your community. And so that is the environment in which she grew up.
How old was the youngest daughter when all this was going on?
She was almost 10.
Yeah. Yeah, and the oldest was 24-ish
or
something, right?
Yes, right.
Okay. That bus ride home after graduation day, Taliban's coming. And that begins a period of what seemed like, in your telling of it, weeks, really, where the women in the household either couldn't or were simply too afraid to go out of the house. And they, she, Kamala specifically, who I gather is a bit headstrong, started going a little stir crazy.
I mean, they couldn't take it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you think about what would you do if you couldn't go farther than your living room? And that was it for these girls. They would roam from room to room. They started, and we talk about this in the book, they start this neighborhood book swap because they are going crazy. So one girl brings over Iranian detective novels, and another girl brings poetry. They are really big readers of Rumi.
Yes.
Right? Who was born in what is now Afghanistan. And they have this whole book swap, and then they still realize that they are just going out of their gourds. They can't take it. You know, these girls had been contributors to their families. They had been studying in school. They had been like women in this country. And overnight, that was gone.
So what was it that made Kamala say, not only do I have to get out of here, but I have to do something to help my family?
So her father was like a lot of men, and I think this is a story that I did not know, and I think a lot of people don't know outside of Afghanistan, which is that security was bad in Afghanistan during the Taliban years for men. And in some ways and in some shapes, worse than it was for women, because what happened was Kamala's father was from the wrong ethnic group and also had supported the previous government. So when they were doing house-to-house searches, they're looking for those kinds of people, even though he was long retired and kept telling his kids, no one cares about me. I'm too old to be of any threat to anybody. You know, I don't care about any of this stuff. I just want to be here with my family. But it became pretty obvious fairly quickly that they were looking for him and people like him. And then she had an older of her two younger brothers who also had to leave because fighting age men were being disappeared basically from the street. So they were either ending up on the front lines or in jail. And so mothers understandably said, no way, that's it. All my son's leaving. And so you had basically able-bodied men leaving the city and older, infirm men, right, who couldn't work, most of them, and younger women left behind in Kabul.
And so he pulls her aside. The father pulls her aside. The father says, I'm leaving town. It's not safe for me, and I will endanger the family if I stay here. And then he pulls Kamala aside, not the oldest daughter, right, the second oldest daughter, and says, you're it. You're driving the train, and the family is going to count on you.
And he says, I have enormous faith in you, that I know that you will provide.
No pressure.
You're 19 and you're supposed to be a teacher, but I know you're going to find a way. And he said it in a way, you know, I asked him afterward, did you ever wonder how this all happened? And he said, no. He said, first God, then myself, and then Kamala. I knew that they would provide because I knew she could do it. And I knew that she had the drive and the ambition to make sure that everything happened.
It's worth saying this one more time. This girl is 19 years old when all of this stuff is happening.
And so he leaves, and she ends up at the head of the household with five brothers and sisters who are counting on her. And her father had left her some savings, but, you know, it isn't going to last forever, and that becomes pretty obvious pretty quickly. And it also becomes pretty obvious pretty quickly that they don't have the money for everything to keep going the way that it was, and that if somebody's going to step up, there's no one else.
And so she says, out of nowhere, because she doesn't know how to sew, I'm going to be a seamstress. Hello?
I think, and it's so funny to me, I was laughing about this with her because, you know, like a lot of educated women, she never learned the skills that her mother tried to pass down. And as I say that, as somebody got kicked out of home ec in seventh grade in Maryland public schools. You know, she really never learned because she
went. You did all right.
We'll see. I could still work on needlepoint.
That's right.
But she got kicked out, you know, sort of her mother's own teaching session because she wasn't taken seriously and she wanted to go back to her books. And it was her older sister who had become this really expert seamstress. And so she says, okay, so I don't know how to sew, but we can do it at home. We can make some money. And we know people who know how to do this. And we're going to get them to teach us.
And so she goes to see the older sister.
She does. And it was a harrowing scene for me to write because for her it was frightening.
Tell the story of the bus ride. I mean, that's the kind of the crazy thing.
So she gets, you are not at this point allowed to leave your house without a chaperone, which could be a 12-year-old boy. And her younger brother is in school. And so she has to go by herself because how else is she going to get there? So she takes the bus across Kabul to her sister's house. And she realizes, first of all, that there's a new women's section in the back of the bus, which had never existed before. And in some ways, this gives her cover. But she does take this risk of going out of the house by herself to get across town to her sister on the bus and sit in the women's section. And she hears from all these women talking about just how bad things are for their family.
I want you guys to do something, though. You've probably seen the pictures of the chadris that these women had to wear. But go like this in front of your eyes and imagine that that's covered by mesh, fine enough to see through but not let you be seen. Okay, and it's obviously your whole body is covered, literally head to toe, and this is your view of the world. So you get on this bus and you're directed to the back and you notice out of the corner of your eye that there's a blanket now separating you from the men up front. You obviously can't give your ticket to the bus driver, who's obviously a man, because obviously that's impure. So there's a 8, 9, 10-year-old boy in the back taking your money from you. I mean, that's how she winds up getting to her sister's house. Goes to her sister and says, you have to help me. I need to be a seamstress because Dad left me in charge. And they spend 3 hours, right, with these sewing machines.
Absolutely. And her sister at first wants to say no. But then she realizes, going back to your point about being headstrong, that her sister's going to do it anyway. And so she might as well help her and do as much as she can to make sure that she does well. But she says you have to follow the rules. And from the very beginning, it is so important, right, that they stay within the Taliban's rules just as much as they can. And she has to promise before her sister will show her anything that she will do everything she can to stay within the rules as much as possible.
And I'm not giving anything, well, I'm giving a little bit away, but the sister later in the story has a break with Kamala over Kamala's headstrongness and refusal to follow rules, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. So she says, I'm going to be a seamstress, learns eventually how to sew. But how do you build a business right. as a woman in Afghanistan under the Taliban? Because if you don't have customers, you don't got nothing.
Shopkeeper by shopkeeper was the answer. And then what happened was you had, she starts with one blue party dress that her sister teaches her how to sew. And people sometimes think, well, fashion, who cared about fashion? You had a war and you had Taliban.
Great
but
point.
The truth is that fashion is universal and women never want to look bad, no matter how bad things are. And that was so true even for this, especially because at family weddings, you kept seeing the same people. So you really didn't want to wear the same dresses, right? I mean, who wants to be wearing the same dress the sixth time around the same cousin?
Well, I mean, the way I read the fashion thing was if and when you were able to go out, you were this blue or black blur, and the sense of fashion you had in yourself was what you had under that chadri, and so that's why it was so important. It was your method of distinguishing yourself.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah. And girls would bring Pakistani postcards that had dresses on them, right, from film stars, often Bollywood film stars, believe it or not. And they'd bring them to Kamala's house, and they'd say, can you make this? Over and over again. And then you have the shopkeeper. So the blue dress, she takes the dress and puts it in her, sort of a black messenger bag, and she goes to what's called Lycée Marianne, which is a bazaar that's right near her house. In a car, now with Kabul traffic, it takes a lot longer, but in a car, if there were no traffic, and at that time there was none, it would take you about 5 minutes. But because they could not get in a car, and because they did not want to be seen by the Taliban walking to the bazaar, they took all of the back roads, and they had the advantage, because even months into Taliban rule, these guys had never lived in a cosmopolitan city. They would be driving the wrong way down one-way streets endlessly, so you had the advantage if you knew your neighborhood. And so she would take the side streets, she shows up at the bazaar, and she meets her first shopkeeper, and she goes up, sort of slides surreptitiously her blue dress across the counter and says, my sister and I need to support our families, and we're wondering if you want to buy these. And this shopkeeper's sort of nervously looking back at him, making sure that the vice and virtue forces, so these guys that are patrolling all the bazaars with batons and TV antennas and any weapon they have that will catch rule breakers, basically, including women whose wrist happens to slip out from their burqa. So he's watching the door for the Amr Bil Maruf, or by vice and virtue, and he says, well, you know, we used to buy all these expensive dresses from Pakistan and Iran, and we don't even have a market or customers for that anymore. So if you can make some dresses, and by the way, some pantsuits, we're in business.
She had done her market research, just to get a little bit of, you know, business economics in here. She had done her market research. She had looked, and she had seen that these shops were low on inventory. And she, I mean, that's kind of where it clicked.
Right.
You're telling this in an unbelievably engaging way, but the walk that she and Rahim, the brother, right?
Yes.
The first walk that she and Rahim take from the house to that first shopkeeper is where I got the palpable sense of fear, the tension and the stress. I mean, that underlies this entire story. It's I can't imagine the stress that this woman had, and all of them.
No, absolutely. And then what happened is, so she goes out the first time, and her sisters are praying the entire time. She tells her sisters that she's going to go out and sell this dress. And they are absolutely apoplectic, because vice and virtue patrols at all times of these bazaars, and especially at the time of the call to prayer. So she has to promise them that she won't be there when the call to prayer sounds, because that's when they really swarm down. And vice and virtue patrolled the city in black Toyota Hilux pickup trucks, sometimes with Quranic verses on the side. And that's how they would drive around. And if they found people who were breaking the rules, they would jump out, and that was it. And so her sisters have this horrible image of any time any woman leaves the house, you just don't know what's going to happen. It could be that somebody decides to pick you up and let you go, or it could be that the worst thing happens, which is you end up in prison. And for a woman in Afghanistan, the whole question of honor is absolutely critical, and to be in prison is worse than almost anything. And that's what her sisters fear. And so she doesn't tell her brother what it is that they're going out to do, because she doesn't want him to know. She sort of grabs him like you do your little brother at the last minute and says, "You're coming with me. We're going to the bazaar." And she just makes him sort of, and he's very protective of her, even though he's much younger. And he's sort of walking to her side, watching to see if anything's going to go wrong. And it's not until they get done with the shopkeeper that they have one moment to enjoy the fact that they've just made their first sale.
Business is no good unless it grows. So how does she take this one shopkeeper and start turning that into a viable enterprise? How does that happen?
I think two things. One is entrepreneurial drive, which I really believe that entrepreneurs are born and not created. So that you may be in Silicon Valley, but if you are in Afghanistan, you have the same drive, the same energy, the same commitment, just a lot more challenges. Right? And so she realizes pretty quickly that she's actually not very good at the sewing part, but she's really good at the business part. She's really good at going to the shopkeepers, explaining why they need the business, and saying, look, we deliver on time, we have good workers, we deliver to the quality, we deliver to the spec, and she tells every girl who comes to her house, we are a professional operation, and we will not be shoddy, and if we say that we're going to deliver, we deliver.
She's kind of a tough boss.
She is. She's a very tough boss. Absolutely.
The older sister, who at this point is 24, has two boys and newborn twins, right?
Right, prematurely born twins.
Prematurely born twins shows up on the doorstep having decided that for their safety, she and her husband and the family need to come home. The sister gets involved in the business, and then it just sort of spreads until this one woman knocks on the door. Sarah knocks on the door. How does that happen?
So every time the door had heard a knock on it, these girls jumped. Because you just didn't know who it was who was going to be showing up and what they wanted with you. And so this knock on the door comes. Raheem, her younger brother, opens the door and says, "Hey, Kamala, there's somebody looking for you." She said, "Oh, you know,
can't be good.
Can't
right?
be good, right?"
Yeah.
And so she gets up and she sees this woman who is old by that time standards, right? She's probably in 30. Right, a very pale sort of.
And this is, sorry, this is a 30 who probably looks 45,
right? Oh,
right?
Easily, I mean, easily looks 45. Yeah. And she comes to Kamala and says, "Look, my cousin's friend tells me that you have work, and I'm a widow. My husband died several years ago. He was a high school principal, and he died with 2 days. You know, he wasn't feeling well, and 2 days later he was dead. And it's our brothers-in-law who are supporting us now. All three of my brother-in-law have lost their job. One worked for the city. The Taliban isn't paying any kind of salaries. He has no income. Another was an aircraft mechanic. The army moved north. There's no work for him. And a third was a computer engineer. So you can imagine there's not a lot of work for him." She said, "I have no way to support my children." And she said, "I've never held a job in my life, but I know how to sew. And I promise you that if you give me work, you will not be sorry." And she can't turn her away. There's just no way. How are you going to say, "I'm sorry, we don't even have enough for our own"? And so from there, she takes her brother out and she says, "That's it. We have to keep growing the business." So they get one shopkeeper to introduce them to another shopkeeper to introduce them to another, and they keep delivering. And every week, more girls are knocking on their door saying, "My friend's friend's friend told me that you have work. And you're the only one right now that we know of in this neighborhood. And it's too far to travel to other neighborhoods because we don't have a chaperone. So we can actually walk to your house pretty quickly and be there without too much fear among our parents." And every week, by the end of the time, she realizes that they have to come up with some kind of system because there are too many young women coming to her house.
And so the Taliban would know, right? And
that's right.
People would find out.
And that was the risk, because the rules were that women could sort of work inside at home as long as they weren't on the streets. But the question was, how many women was too many women in one place? Because you couldn't congregate. So they come up with Sarah's help, they come up with a schedule for how many girls can be at their house at any one time. And they come up with rules. No, you must wear the burqa if you're going to Kamala's house. You must never be seen talking to a man on the street. No high heels, because the sound of high heels on the sidewalk is seen by the Taliban as suspicious or, you know, arousing. And so you can't do that. No white socks, because that's the color of the Taliban flag, and no nail polish or makeup.
Because they check for that. I'm thinking, though, as I'm reading this, come on, you can't have 30, 40, 50, whatever it is, women coming and going from one house and not have the Taliban know about it. And sure enough, through a wedding dress, it comes out that nudge, nudge, wink, wink, they know. Tell us that story.
So one afternoon, the girls are working, and Kamala, they get another knock on the door, and this woman rushes in. And by that time, they're sort of used to clients coming to their house. Again, with a sort of Bollywood sticker, sometimes with Indian fashion magazines, sometimes with Titanic movie posters.
Oh, yeah, that was, I love that part. Yeah. Titanic apparently was huge in Kabul in 1998. Who knew?
Massive. And so these girls, they're kind of used to that. But this woman rushes in and says, you need to make us three dresses overnight. And Malika Kamala just says, look, I'm a good seamstress. But I mean, that's sort of, yeah. Right. I mean, even we have limits and, you know, we'd love to help you, but give me a break. And she goes to Kamala, and Kamala feels so glad that she can finally return her favor to her sister. And she says, look, I'll help you. We'll get all the girls who are working with us. We'll get it done. That's fine. We can't turn down business. Money is money.
Right.
And so the woman sort of walks around the corner and realizes just how many girls are working there. And she says, look, we've been driving around Kabul City all day trying to find a place like this. We can't find anybody because male tailors can't make dresses for women anymore. It's a Taliban rule. And all the tailors we know are men. And so she says, so actually we need six dresses. She says, what? You know, come on, give me a break. You know, really, like this is one step too far. She says, and by the way, we need them by tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah.
So Kamala says, look, we're already in this far. We'll just get all these girls to try to stay as late as they can. They say, anybody who can stay, we'll give you dinner with spaghetti on us. Can you, can you stay? And so a lot of girls wanted the work. And they said, okay, we'll stay. And they quickly realized that it's a wedding that they are fitting the bride for. Because they bring the fabric, and one is white and one is green in dresses, both the colors of green, color of Islam, and white, the wedding dress color. And then all the dresses for the mother and the sisters who have been brought in
tow. What could possibly go wrong?
Right. So they are all working in there. They have the pins out. They only have power intermittently. So whenever they have power, they run to use the sewing machines. And whenever they don't, it's hand. And so they all have a sort of little factory going with the young women working under Malika and Kamala's guidance. And the next day, they're sort of feeling pretty good. Like, look, we're in a pretty good place. And 2 hours before they are supposed to be done, the mother rushes in again and says, look, I know we said 6 o'clock, but we actually need 4 o'clock, and you got to go now. And they look at each other saying, this is what is going on. We've never had it. We've had unusual clients, but this is even unusual for us. And she says, okay, but I have to press it. So they put there is no power at the time, so they put it on a burner, and they put the iron on. They start to press all the wedding dresses. They start folding everything up. They give it to the 7-year-old girl who is now living with Kamala because her mother has asked her to take her in because she can't feed her. And Kamala has said yes. So the 7-year-old girl becomes their gopher. She stands like this. They start piling on the dresses. She walks outside to bring them in, and she realizes that, yes, it's a wedding, but there's also black Hilux pickup trucks. So they have just spent the last 20-whatever hours making dresses for a Taliban wedding.
How about that? And in point of fact, later in the story, a girl comes and says, listen, I have a message from my father.
That's right.
Because what had happened was that the civilian men who were left in town needed work. I mean, you tell the story.
Absolutely, but this is exactly right. It all came down to economics. There were a lot of neighborhood Talibs who had been teachers one day and Taliban the next because they needed whatever money it was to support their families. And so there were Taliban who knew what these girls were doing. So this young girl comes up to Kamala one day when they're working, and she says, look, I have a message, you say, from my father. He says, he knows that you're an honorable woman and that what you're doing is supporting our neighborhood. And he says that as long as you stay within the rules and don't ever let any man come in this house and don't talk to strangers, he will do everything he can to protect you. And he'll tell you when the vice and virtue is really going to be out. And he will let you know if they're talking about you, because that's what would happen was at the mosque, people would start asking questions. Do you know this person? Is there a business? Are there too many women? And that's what would happen. So he said he would send word if that ever began.
This is such a visual story, and I probably should have set this up better in the beginning. Tell us about the house that Kamala and her family live in. Give us a picture of it.
So it is a house on a very, very busy street in Kabul, which is good because it's close to the bus stop, but it's bad because when you patrol, where do you patrol? You patrol the main streets. And so it is literally on the corner of a main thoroughfare in Karkana, which is their neighborhood, which is in the northern part of Kabul. And it is a pretty modest house behind a very high gate, which ends up being a very good thing for these girls, because you can't walk by and see what's happening in there. Somebody has to physically open the gate, which gives them at least 15 seconds right. If somebody comes in to either send girls out the back or hide people upstairs. And it is a very modest, flat house, which has living space, which was once a living room and has now become a sewing factory for these girls in the neighborhood.
So we're going to stop telling the story there so you buy the book. But I want to get from you a sense of your experiences in Afghanistan. Your introduction is the first time you landed, and tell us about that. Your initial straight off the plane reactions, prefaced by the fact that it takes you like what 40 hours traveling to get there. Yeah,
I think I probably grew up in a lot of ways with this book, from the first trip in 2005 to being there even in December.
You were how old in 2005?
Oh, it wasn't even really an age thing. I think I was 30-esque at that time, right? But it was just what you see and the experiences you have and sort of the grace under incredibly difficult circumstances that you see around you all the time. And I think that is what makes you keep coming back as a reporter. Because even when security is awful and you know that you could be in the wrong place at the wrong time, just like anybody else in Afghanistan, you feel like people have given your stories and their stories to you, and their stories of real courage under incredibly difficult circumstances, I think, make you feel like you have a responsibility to share that, especially because we're so used to seeing women in these situations as victims to be pitied rather than survivors to be respected. And here were these girls who had taken incredible risks at a very dangerous time, not just for their own sakes, but for their entire community. And I thought, you know, you don't have a choice. This is what, you know, you need to bring this story to readers. But when I landed the first time in 2005, I was just as green as a reporter can be. I mean, my headscarf was falling off. I didn't know that my fixer could not actually come to pick me up at the airport. So I waited for 2 hours in the lobby of the Kabul airport wondering why he had forgotten me. And the truth was that because of bombings, you can't get close to the airport. You actually have to get your silver trolley and push your luggage all the way out, really the length of 2 football fields. And, you know, there is no way to keep your headscarf on as a novice, right? So I'm, you know, trying to fidget with that. I'm sweating. I'm hot. I'm like, what in the world have I gotten myself into? And everyone had told me there was no story, that there were no business women in Afghanistan, that, you know, that even the customs guy at Dulles Airport said to me, why are you going for 2 weeks? This will take you half a day.
Wow.
And yet what you found on the ground was so different.
Obviously, you can't report in Kabul in heels and a little black dress.
No.
How do you go about that?
So I wear, I am the dowdiest person I see all week. And in fact, I am often incredibly disappointing for the women I interview because they expect like a glamorous American reporter to show up, not a dumpier version of them. Right, because I come with like a huge black pants and black socks, black aerosoles, big black T-shirt, a jacket I get from the Islamic clothing store in Anaheim, and a really bad scarf. Because the truth, and no makeup, and a ponytail. And the truth is, you really don't want people to think you are worth money, and you don't want people to ask anybody you are interviewing questions because you really can put them in danger. Especially if they ask, what are they asking you about? And they say, oh, the Taliban years. So I could pass coloring-wise for a cousin or a friend or a friend's friend's cousin, which, and as we're talking about the extended family, is pretty normal in Afghanistan. So I'd show up, and they were looking for Pamela Anderson, and it was sort of me. But, you know, so that's how we did it. And my fixer, Mohammed, my colleague who is in the book, I could not do any of this without him. He is really a lifeline, and I couldn't even get around the city without him driving because women don't really drive.
Last time you were there was a couple of 3 months ago, right?
Yeah.
Still a palpable sense of physical fear?
Among foreigners, yes. Yeah. Among Afghans, it's very different because people live with a level of proximity to their own mortality that we are not used to here. And so you have to get used to the fact that everybody you know has lost people. My colleague Mohammed one day was waiting for me at the Serena Hotel, which is the only four-star hotel in Kabul, and his friend walked to get aspirin and got hit by a rocket that the Taliban had sent in from the hills. And that was one day when we were just out reporting. I mean, anybody who's reported from there has lost people that they know. And so you sort of have to learn to live with it because there's no way to go on otherwise. So I think Afghans have a much sort of more dark humor sort of approach about it. My Muhammad always says, Miguel, it's Kabul. It's Afghanistan. What do you expect? And I think for foreigners, it's very different because I once lived in a house with security guys, which was a whole other story for another book for another time. but they would do these PowerPoint presentations before dinner about who was kidnapping whom for how much and what group to watch out for. So, you know, how am I supposed to do that in the car when I'm going from story to story? Like, you know, at a certain point, if it happens, it happens. And I think everybody adopts that attitude who's been there long enough, but you can always tell the new arrivals.
Yeah,
because they are obsessed with this. What if I'm in the wrong place? Well, what if? I mean, you're not in Tahiti. You know, I mean, I always say if you're taking danger pay, you're in danger.
So we'll go 5 more minutes, Gail and I. Think about what you want to know about this story and about Gail. I want to end my conversation with you on the way the Taliban in Afghanistan ended. After September 11th and the American attacks. Describe that briefly and what was going through Kamala's mind specifically as literally as the bombs were falling.
So their neighborhood was one of the most dangerous to be in during the American bombing campaign because they were near military depots, they were near Taliban headquarters, they were near prison sites, they were near all the kinds of things that become targets. Mm-hmm. And everybody left their neighborhood except for them. And her mother said, look, we're not going to leave because I am not going to have my daughters be caught on a road and be made, you know, be killed. If we're going to die, we're going to go in our own home. And she felt very strongly about that. And they had never left their house for all of those years of upheaval and war. And she wasn't going to have her daughters be, as she called it, refugees at that time. So they stayed in the house. And the bombs literally, like their house shook from the proximity of the bombings. And she, Kamala, would comfort her younger siblings because they would all come running in. They would all sit, every night they would get ready for what was going to come. They would all huddle into one room and wait to see what was going to happen. And in the end, you know, the Taliban would actually drive around as with these anti-aircraft guns as if they really could hit anything. There was absolutely, as you know from the neighborhood, there's no way you could hit something. But they were not so much routed as they just decided that we're going to leave. And so they sort of withdraw from Kabul, and no one believes it. And for the first few days, Kamala's mother says, I don't care about anybody else celebrating. My girls are staying in the house. And she makes them stay in this crawl space under the stairs the first night because you don't know whether marauding bands of men are going to come into your house. And what side are they on? Who knows at that point?
Yeah. Who's going to be first? Raise your hand, we'll get a microphone to you. Yes, ma'am, right there on the aisle.
Thank you so much for your book and for a wonderful conversation. It was very enjoyable for both of you. You just started talking about her mom, and I was just wondering, because I was going to ask about dad, but you asked. Can you tell us a little bit more about mom, about the mother?
Yeah, so her mother had 11 children and started early and was never educated, never had the opportunity to be educated. And she has a heart condition. She was pretty frail by this time, but she loved to come and hear what the girls were doing. So she goes to the north when her father leaves. She leaves with her father because there was no real question of her mother staying behind with them when her father leaves. But she comes back when her father actually, there's a scene in the book where her father comes back and says, I have to leave the country because it's even in the north, they're looking for people like me. And so her mother becomes this sort of comforting presence. But she comes to make sure that everything is okay, and then she leaves again because she knows that the girls are fine. But she listens to all the complaints and all the problems of the girls in the neighborhood when they come to Kamala's house, and she serves as sort of a mother for all of them.
The father and one of the brothers goes to Iran, right? Yeah.
And they go to look for money and go, you know, to work, basically. But Kamala actually sends them money there the entire time.
Yeah. Hi, yes, ma'am.
I'm very happy to be here and you are very exciting. And I am looking forward to purchasing the book. Unfortunately, I cannot afford to purchase it this evening, but I'm looking forward to purchasing the book. I am a severe victim of crime. I said publicly, I was in a situation where I said publicly, I don't want to be pitied. I want respect. Mm. And I have been in a severe situation for many years. And respect is very important. When people pity you, they are actually destroying you. It's important that you get respect. And I respect you for writing the book. And I would like to know, are you still in contact with the family that the book is based on?
I am. I talk to them pretty regularly. So Kamala just had a baby, her second baby, just a few months back. And she has just returned to Afghanistan from the UK when everybody in her country is going the opposite direction. Right? She went back because she has a business now, which in the opening of the book is how I meet her, is because I come to interview her about her new business. And she is, I think, every inch a patriot who believes that she will not be kicked out of her own country and will not be made afraid in her own country. And as she said when we were talking about this book, she said, this is my country, and you see in this book, we did nothing wrong. We stayed within the rules. And people don't know our story, so I think she thinks it's kind of silly that people find her story remarkable, because I think like so many exceptional people, she sees absolutely nothing unusual in what she did. But I think that she is really gratified to see that people have responded, and that, you know, when we get emails from a father in Juneau, Alaska, saying that he hopes his daughter has the same values and same courage, I think that means something.
Thank you very much for a great conversation. I'd like to give a small background before I pose the question. I grew up in Saudi Arabia, so I can see the inspiration the Taliban had for all of their rules from the laws that the Saudi Arabia has imposed. In fact, you can see that, in fact, they probably have gone a bit further.
That's right. Their vice and virtue was actually more energetic than the Saudi Arabia one in which it was based. Yeah.
Right. So I was slightly confused and a bit unsure that why exactly the woman-only congregation would be prohibited, because I couldn't see anything of that while living in Saudi Arabia. So why was that in the Afghanistan case?
So that was actually not their biggest problem. The biggest problem was when she went out in public to the shopkeepers, and that was really when the danger came. The issue of being at home was how many people at once, because and who found out. Because the Taliban was never monolithic. It could be that, as we were just talking about, there were a lot of neighborhood Taliban who said, this is wonderful. You're supporting our community and we support you. But there were also people who, if they found out that too much was happening, were they also teaching girls? Were they also, you know, having strange men coming who knew what was going to happen? So it became a question of capacity. At a certain point, there were too many women in one place, and congregating for men and women was forbidden. So that was really the issue. But the biggest risk, aside from the number of people in their home at any one time, was being out in public. But yes, they were more energetic than the Saudi vice and virtue.
Gail, thank you for telling your story, or the story of Afghanistan women. When you were telling the story about the wedding dress and that the Taliban found out, or they then communicated with her, Kamal, I thought you were going to end the story with, we'll protect you, but it's going to cost you. And it seems like now you hear the stories of Afghanistan about the rampant corruption. Was that not the case under the Taliban?
So the Taliban, we talk, it's a great question.
Yeah,
these
question.
Are all, you know, you all have engaged with this so beautifully, so thank you. But this question of corruption is central right now to what's going on in Afghanistan. And the truth was that in the Civil War years, it was warring warlords who were just ripping people off right and left. And it was awful for girls. So you would have a situation where warring commanders would decide on, they saw a girl on the street and decide that they wanted to marry them, and they would take them. And those girls were never heard from again. And so by the time the Taliban came, they were welcome in many quarters by people who said, we've had it. We've had enough. Okay, so our girls can't go on the street. That's a problem. But the bigger problem is if they never can come home again. And so you see now a repeat of this cycle, where people say, no, we don't like the Taliban. Look, we think they are bullies, right? This is not our brand of Islam. This is not Afghan. This is not at all the way we practice our faith, and our faith is absolutely central to everything we do. But we are getting preyed upon by our government. And so when the police rip you off and your local officials rip you off and you are asked for 20% off the top if you're an entrepreneur who happens to win a contract, there is a certain point where you say, look, I mean, this isn't great, but good Lord, at least they weren't corrupt. And that was true of the Taliban. I mean, largely, there were exceptions, but they were stories, and we talk about this in the book, of them putting black coal on people's faces and driving them around the city in the back of the pickup truck because that was the sign that they were corrupt. And that was the way that they shamed them, was putting coal on them and making them be publicly humiliated. And that, I will tell you, does not happen now, any level of public humiliation for people who are fleecing people. It is absolutely a game of get as much as you can for as long as you can.
It's interesting you mentioned faith and religion, because other than the obvious fact of the Taliban being inspired to some degree by Sharia law, yeah, Islam is not present much in this book, which I thought was sort of interesting now based on that question.
And it was intentional, because we never have talked about it. It is always a question of faith, and faith in the same way that everybody practices their faith. And her faith informs, I think, everything that she does, which is that she really believes that God will protect her because she is doing the right thing. And that is something that has never stopped for her, and that continues unto this day. She always, you know, I asked her if she thought that she was going to be found out during any one of her public outings. And she said, you know, look, we all go at some point, and God will decide at what time and place mine is. But as long as I'm doing the work that I believe my faith has taught me to do, that is what I'm going to keep doing. And, you know, she even breaks, as you mentioned, with her sister at a certain point when she gets a job with the UN. And her sister
says, don't give it away. Come on. It's right? You got to sell it.
Right. Exactly.
All right.
So I won't tell you that. But there's another family drama that you'll be enjoying.
I'm trying to help you up. You're killing me.
Hi. When you talk about this family, you depict it as, from my perception, as an unusual family where education of the daughters was valued. Have you gotten around Afghanistan and met what is a more normal family, and what are their views regarding the role of women, their views of the West, and their views of the relationship between the men and the women? How do the men view the women?
Yeah.
So it's a really important question. I think it is a question of education, and it is also a question of open-mindedness, and you see that all across the country. It is not the rule, but it is not also the minor exception, I think, that we think it is here. You see a lot of men who are supporting their daughters to go to school. Right now, the biggest problem is security, because people are really fearful of sending their girls to school when there is so much happening on the streets between bombings and kidnappings and acid attacks. These are all things that are happening. And so people are incredibly fearful about what would happen to their girls. But even, I've met, you know, illiterate men who are bound and determined that their daughters will get educated. And so the difference, I think, between them and others is, what have you been exposed to? Because when people have been exposed to educated women, and I don't mean college education, I just mean sort of basic literacy and able to move around, that changes their mind. Kamala has this amazing story that we talk about where she goes to Kandahar after the Taliban fall, and that's the seat of the Taliban. And she is incredibly nervous because she's giving this presentation to a room full of men who have been asked to come to a gender sensitivity training. And when you see the pictures of this, it does not look like any room you want to be speaking at the front of the mic to. Because you know that people are going to say, what are you doing here? And she starts by citing the Quran. And she says, I've not come here as your teacher. I've come here as your daughter and your sister and your friend, here to share what I've learned. And at the end of the 2 days, one of the men who she was most nervous about, the very conservative mullah from Kandahar, comes up to her and says, if I could be certain that my daughter would turn out like you, I would send her to school tomorrow. And that's why I think these homegrown, because they are homegrown, right? They are as Afghan as the girl who's never left her compound, that these homegrown examples and role models are so important to talk about, because they are the exception, but they are not the only exceptions. And they are running around their country really creating change and making people realize that it doesn't have to be a threat when girls get educated. And I want to share one last thing on the point of men. I was very nervous, and we talk about this at the end of the book, I was very nervous about meeting Kamala's brother. And she said to me, he wants to meet you. And I said, oh, no.
Yeah, that's so interesting you were nervous, because I don't understand that. I didn't understand it when I read it, but now that I got you here, hit it.
So I was nervous because men are worried about the women and their family's honor. And I had this real fear that he was going to say, my sister's great, but this is not the time to be talking about what happened with the Taliban. Because in case you hadn't noticed, they're resurgent. And so I had mustered every argument. I had my reporter's notebook. I mean, we're sitting in the Kabul Inn, which is kind of a dumpy hotel, which is not like a real attack target, so that's why we chose it, and watching bad Bollywood videos in the corner on the television. And he comes in an hour and a half late. And I said, oh, no. Mom, I said, don't worry. I've talked to him. I've told him that you're a good person. You know, you're not going to exploit his family. It's good. I said, you know. So I go to my notes. I'm getting ready. And he says, Gail, I wanted to meet you because I wanted to thank you. And I wanted to thank you because my sister was so brave at such a difficult time. And she supported not just herself, but our whole family and our whole neighborhood. And she sent money to me in Pakistan and my father in Iran. And I always hoped that a foreigner would come and tell her story because she deserves it. And I think he probably understood more than I did at that time why this story matters and why people connect to it, which is it's sort of a universal story about what you do for those you love.
When I think about people who support women in situations like this, Muhammad Yunus comes immediately to mind. Mm-hmm. And
Let's remind folks who he is. He's from Grameen Bank. He's sort of the father of microcredit and microlending.
And he started it by, as he was an economics professor, walking to school every day and seeing women making baskets. And they made no profit on the baskets because they were getting the money from usurers. And so he said to the one woman one day, how much do you need to make your next batch of baskets? And I believe the total was something like $15. So he gave her the $15. She sold the baskets and could keep the profit, and thus an idea began. So my question is, how did she pay for, originally, the fabric, the sewing machines? Where did her financing come from?
So in the book, in the scene where she goes to see her sister, it is her sister who helps to finance her at the beginning, and who, at a really desperate time for her own family, gives her a microloan to get started.
And a sewing machine, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Eventually, she gives her a sewing machine. Kamala kind of has to prove that she's worthy, right? That she deserves a sewing machine because her sister will be losing her own sewing machine if she gives her one to borrow. But that's how she gets started. Thank you.
Yeah, up there.
Is this book going to be available in Afghanistan, and will people be able to read it?
So it is not likely to be in the immediate term. It's a question of whether Farsi language publishers express interest. Kamala has read it, of course, and people who are in her community have read it. And they, we've been sending them some, so they know how to get it. But what's been interesting is that aid workers working in Afghanistan have started to figure out that they can get it through through their post office that all American aid workers have. And so they've gone to Amazon and gotten it that way. So you do see it that way. But it's interesting because everybody in Afghanistan knows that women worked during the Taliban. And so when I tell people about the story, they all kind of say, oh, that's nice. My mother worked too. My sister had a business, because she was not the only woman working during those years. She's just one story that stands for so many others.
Anybody else? Yes, down in the front.
I love the book, Gail. When I was reading it, the descriptions of Malika's made-to-measure gowns, and Kamala's, they were so productive. But I couldn't figure out the relation between what they were paid per dress or pantsuit or wedding gown and, say, feeding their family. Did a gown feed a family for a week or 3 days? Or what was the relationship there?
It's a great question. And part of the reason why we didn't get into that so much was because the exchange rates, because the currency was always changing and inflation was rampant. So what would buy you food for 1 week would buy you half a loaf of naan bread the next month. And they really didn't know how to manage an economy. And I think this was so fascinating for me in researching this book, was that the economic story of the Taliban years is utterly forgotten because everybody remembers the politics. But people were desperate. I mean, they were selling baby dolls and shoelaces and windows and doors, anything that had economic value. So at the beginning, they actually could buy more with what they were earning. And by the end, they were definitely surviving and had some left over, and they were definitely employing other women and giving them shares of the profits. But you were never doing anything other than surviving. And I asked the question once. I said, oh, did you save money since this business did so well? And Kama looked at me and just started laughing. She said, haven't you been researching this for a few years? You know, don't you know that it was just surviving was such an accomplishment at this time? And that was all anybody was trying to do, was be able to feed their kids and be able to maybe give some work to people in their neighborhood. But it's a great question.
Yeah. Is this the last one, Maureen? Okay, last one. I'm not in charge, Anne.
This is kind of a stupid question, but you know when that's what they say. Wait till you hear it. When you
how to bury the lead? But go ahead.
I know.
When they found out the dresses that they were making were going to women from the Taliban, it's a kind of a two-part question. One is, did anyone say, "Why are we making them dresses?" Mm. You know, they're part of the people that are really destroying our lives. And the second question is, what about the women of Taliban families? What is there, are there pressures within communities that, you know, you were, your brothers were our oppressors? Yeah. What does that do to civil society, or have they been able to mend as well as possible with everything that goes on?
It's not at all a dumb question. It's a very relevant question to the discussion going on and about the future of Afghanistan right now. When they figured out they were making these dresses, no, because everybody was in survival mode. So you didn't have time to be complaining about what these guys were doing to you, you know, or what the regime meant. You were really thinking about, where are we going to get money from tomorrow for not just ourselves, but for my father in Iran and my brother in Pakistan and for all these girls who are coming to our house. So you may one day take a second to sit down and think about it, but when every interview I did, and there were some really tough ones over the years of doing this, every interview I did, these girls would say, I don't remember doing anything but working. You know, I don't remember doing anything but thinking about it. And it was their coping mechanism in the same way that work is for a lot of us, right? Which is, you know, when everything else is going wrong, you know you can do your work. And that was how they did it, was they didn't even bother to complain most of the time. I think at the beginning, yes. But by that time, people were exhausted, and the war went on the entire Taliban years. They never controlled the entire country. So conflict never ended, and problems only multiplied, and then there was drought. So then by this time, people are just, they're worn out. And so I think they were more grateful for the fact that they knew they at least had a little bit of room to maneuver in, given that these guys clearly knew what they were doing, than they were politically energized. And the question now, really, what you asked, second part of your question, is very relevant to the question of reconciliation and what happens next with Afghanistan. A lot of people have moved on because that people have been through too much to hold grudges, right? There has been 3 decades of conflict. Everyone you know has lost someone. And so at a certain point, people are ready to get on with it. And women in particular are desperate for peace. They really want their children to know something better. But the question is, if you negotiate a peace with the Taliban, what happens next? Will they respect your right to work and go to school? The Afghan constitution now says that women have the right to equal opportunity, which means they can go to work and go to school. But if you negotiate for peace and with which Taliban, from what country, and with whose backing, and with whose funding are they, and will they really agree to respect your rights to go to work and go to school and contribute to your family, which is all that these women are asking for. A final thought, which is that I had an interesting discussion. I went to the U.S. Embassy to give a talk that they asked for about women in economics. And an American aid worker actually asked me if women were really not willing to negotiate on their rights. And I said,
think about that.
Why should they negotiate away their right to work? And why should we fund it? And I thought, if this is within the U.S. Embassy, who knows what's going on in the discussions that are happening now in terms of reconciliation. So I would end with one call to action, which is that, you know, people are so tired of this war, right? There's no question that people in the American public are exhausted. But there are real people, not just the military stories, who are fighting every day for something better. And if the American public doesn't engage, American policymakers will move on without women and girls like this. So I do think, I would say, in whatever way you wish to, there is a way to get engaged on this.
It's called The Dressmaker of Carcana. It's worth a read.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.